Hello, everybody. I'm an alcoholic. My name's Keith. By God's grace, Alcoholics Anonymous, rooms full of people like you and a little effort on my own. I haven't had to take a drink or do any kind of narcotics at all since May 11th, 1976, and for that I'm especially grateful. You bet. Glad to be here, glad to be sober. He's an absolute miracle. He tried to do his own version of the Texas Chainsaw Massacre. And he's very fortunate to be here. I'm glad that he made it. Thanks to Mayo Clinic. He lisps a little, but that's going to heal.
Only with 4 years.
I'm glad to know how to spell how you pronounce that name, because I called you Lefty. And Taper. Don't even ask about him. If you wonder what that hum is over there to my left, that's friends of mine came all this way so that I could say I had friends. A bunch from Minneapolis and the Garage Dogs and the Deal guys from Des Moines, Iowa. I want to thank them for coming over this weekend to support our being here, Sue and I, fortunate we get to do these things together, and have been for a long time. I'm very blessed. And my wife stayed with me. We just celebrated 42 years of marriage, and we've been together so long, we're starting to get replacement parts. Sue just had a titanium hip replacement, and today we were in Minneapolis trying to get a cart to get from one gate to the next, and she threw two old people off the cart and their baggage. And she said, turned around to me and said, "Don't you think I'm getting better?" She's not a doormat Al-Anon, I'll tell you that for sure. Well, we have a lot of fun. The security guard wanted to frisk me, and she hit him with her cane. And he said, "So you're going to Minneapolis, huh?" I always send her to the counter to, you know, she goes up to the counter at the airport. She does counter a lot better than me. And she'll go up and says, "Anybody told you they love you today?" And we're on the next flight. I walk up to the counter, and the guy says, "Take a seat, sit in that section, and I'll let you know when to come up here." Yeah, I don't know. They profile me. I don't know why. I laugh. She smokes, and so she has to go to all these different weird places in the airports to smoke with all these weird people. Yeah, she says, "I'll be back in a little bit." "Yeah, you will." And she goes off and smokes in the bars. And it's a good thing she's an Al-Anon. She can sit in the bars with the drunks and smoke, you know. And she was sitting in there, some gals pounding down doubles, and Sue went in there and sat down and said, "Okay, if I sit next to you to smoke?" And the lady said, "Sure." And Sue's smoking in there, and she looks, and all these empty glasses around this lady, and Sue says, "Isn't it terrible that they isolate the smokers and the drunks?" And the lady says, "I beg your pardon." I didn't think of myself as that. Pretty soon, here she come running back. We always have a lot of fun in the airports, taking trips and stuff. That's good. We went to Arkansas a couple of weeks ago, and, you know, they've had all those hurricanes down in Florida, so that has an adverse effect on Arkansas. The tidewater, or whatever it is, underneath the land, under the water, backs up, and so do all the sewers in Arkansas. So we get into this motel a Friday afternoon and having the convention there, and all the sewers are backed up. I don't know, man. The people at the desk, I went in there and said, "You got a room?" They said, "Yeah, but no toilet." "All right, I'll take it. I've just been flying for 12 hours without a toilet. I can surely go all night." But what they did, they plugged my room into the desk. So everybody that called the desk complaining about toilets or needing toilet paper or whatever, they called my room. And so like from midnight on, people would call up and say, I've called 6 times for toilet paper. When are you going to bring it? I'll be right over. What room are you in? And 2 o'clock, 3 o'clock. And you know what? The next day when I talked, I told that story and all these hands went up. It was all Alkies calling all night. What were you doing up wanting toilet paper? The toilet won't even flush. Well, I wanted to be prepared, so when it did, I'd be ready. And I tell you, funny. But I tell you, it wasn't always funny. It wasn't always funny to me, anyway. I don't know if I was born an alcoholic or not, but when I had my first drink, an alcoholic was born. And I was born into an alcoholic family. Everybody around there pretty much was alcoholic. That's good if you're a budding alcoholic because there's plenty of alcohol around. And so there was always alcohol hid around everywhere and whatever. And I was reared. What does that mean, Beth? Reared. Raised. In California, you're raised. I'm from home of the fruits and nuts. I'd like to have Andy introduce Bugs Bunny. I need to get him out there at the Holiday Inn there at Disneyland to introduce Mickey Mouse and Bugs Bunny instead of Spam. Let's get him to do something. But as soon as I got here, I called California. I said, you're not going to believe it, but I'm in the Spam capital of the world. There was a long silence on the other end. But anyway, I was reared in Oklahoma, and where the men are men and the sheep are unscared. But they had county option, and the Baptists bought all the liquor license, so you know they had a lot of bootleggers and homebrew and White Lightning and stuff you didn't put no floating umbrella in it, I'll guarantee you. Didn't have an olive or anything, little foo-foo thing hanging off the side of it. That thing looked like white gasoline. And the closest thing I ever came to drinking like I did in Oklahoma is when I got to California and had 102 beer and a Yukon Jack whiskey. You could get a fifth of Yukon Jack for $1.98 and a six-pack of 102 for about 92 cents. And I was drinking for effect. But I grew up, and they had in Oklahoma Panhandle, and my dad's an alcoholic. He's, by his own admission, he's just celebrated 27 years of sobriety, and he's 89 years old. He's still alive. You know, he's out there hanging on, man. He's hanging on. January the 1st, he'll have 90 years. And I called my sister the other day, and she said, I don't know if he's ever going to die. I said, well, not before January the 1st. I can tell you, he's going to hang on till he's 90. Don't make no difference what. And that's my dad. And a hanger-oner. I was going down the road the other day, and it dawned on me. I remember when my dad said, I just want to live to the year 2000. And he overshot the mark by 4 years. That's alcoholic, you know that? But where I grew up, they drank like that, homebrew. And I started out on that kind of stuff. And by the time I was 12 years old, when I was 12 years old, I got a farm permit. I could drive to drive farm vehicles and what have you. So you got a driver's license. And I had a car when I was 12, and I had my first hit and run and leaving the scene of the accident when I was 12 and 3 months. Yeah. Started out early. I didn't know that's what it was. I just was leaving, driving off. I was sitting on a pillow, and I couldn't see what I'd run over, and the car just went bump, bump. So I... But I was going to get some beer. I was going to get some beer. I know that. And the 3 guys in the car with me didn't say, stop, you've run over somebody. They said, hurry up, let's get out of here. They're all 3 dead because of alcoholism, though. But at any rate, as a result of that little incident while they locked me up with a bunch of other little terrorists. I didn't realize that's what it was then. But from the time I was 12 and a half years old, I was locked up in some kind of a reformatory school, some thing. I had barbed wire around it, and the girls were over on the other, in the other compound with barbed wire around them. And nothing special, you know, just that you couldn't leave if you wanted to. I didn't want to, really. Growing up in an alcoholic home, being locked up over there was better than my house. You know, my home wasn't dysfunctional. It was just insane. It was like a combat zone at my house. You know, it was just crazy people. I love them. You know, I tell you what, I never, ever put down my family because of alcoholism or anything. I grew up with selfish, self-centered, self-seeking, neurotic, insane people, and I got out of there alive, baby. And I'm going to tell you something. At 36 years old, I dropped into Alcoholics Anonymous sober, and I sat down in a room full of selfish, self-centered, self-seeking, neurotic, insane people, and they said, "Welcome, you're home." And I tell you, the things I learned to survive in my own family has helped me many times right here in AA. I don't put them down at all, man. I'm grateful for the teachings. My daughter grew up in a just an insane environment. And when she was 17 years old, she was a model. She wanted to be a model, and she went to Japan and modeled over there several times. But when she first went to Japan, she had to move around in the ground, or, you know, buses and trolleys and what have you, whatever. She couldn't really speak Japanese, and there was a lot of real wild things, people, what have you, and gangs. And after she got over there, she said these some gang guys took out after her, and she just stopped and turned around. And they just ran off. She said, she called me and said, "Dad, it works." I said, "What?" She said, "I faked it, but I don't know where all that came from." I said, "All your teachings, teachings, how to survive at home." Yeah. Then she went over to Milan, Italy, and went into some NATO base to go to an Al-Anon meeting, and she had to ride on a train with all these jarheads, drunk jarheads, and they were all hitting on her and her Al-Anon newcomers. And she could speak Italian and whatever, and she could speak English. So these jarheads were all drunk, talking trash about the girls. And my daughter said, she turned around and said, "That's no way to act. You represented the United States." And I said, boy, they sobered up real quick. And just, and she called me up and she said, "You know, they asked me, aren't you afraid to ride on that train with all those jarheads and all those people that, you know, trying to be mean and ugly?" And she said, "No, I told them they're just like your friends. My dad had friends like that around the house all the time." So, you know, teachings aren't all bad. If you live long enough, you'll get to use them. But I got out of my little educational period there when I was 16 and a half years old, and I'd learned a lot of things, and I also got involved with some outside issues, but that was okay. 16 and a half years old, I was very well educated, and I hit the street and went home and hung around for a little while. My grandmother said it doesn't take any more effort to marry a rich woman than it does to marry a poor woman. She just didn't tell me it takes more effort to keep one. But I married this little gal. Her dad had all kinds of money. He was one of the 10 richest men in the state of Texas, at least. And he was giving us some money to live on, what have you. And it wasn't enough. It's never enough for an alcoholic of my type. Enough is never enough. And so I was transporting this automobile for somebody to enhance my income. And I was in Fort Worth, Texas, headed for Dallas, Texas, and had another hit and run, leaving the scene of the accident. I don't know when it goes, bump, bump, I just go on. Anyway, I got arrested, and there was some burlap bags in the trunk of this car I was transporting for this guy. I didn't know who he was. I'd stole the car. And that's my luck, isn't it? Oh, man. I told the judge, "What if there had been a dead body in that car that I stole? Why don't you just send me to jail for stealing the car instead of transporting marijuana?" said, you better be glad there was no dead body in that car. You'd be going to jail for a lot longer. And anyway, as a result of that, I had to go do 18 months in a place that had a taller barbed wire fence and bigger men, and with a lot more outside issues, which is the beginning of my abandonment issues. Fast track education. And I got out of there a couple of years or so later and called my two very best friends, Oily and Goose, and I told them I'll be coming in on the train. And so they got a couple of fruit jars full of White Lightning, jar full of Bennies, and some homebrew. Went down to the train station waiting for me to come in. They went down there 3 days early. So when I got there, they drank everything up almost, and the battery was dead. I've been listening to the radio for 3 days. You know, but I was home, and so we went down to Wolf Creek to the dance. Wolf Creek's where there's no law comes to Wolf Creek dance, I'll guarantee you. And I got in there midnight. The band was taking intermission, and a big stage down there. I walked through the back door, grabbed a Coke bottle, and spun it down across the dance floor and said, let the meanest sucker in the house bring that back. I'm home. And it looked like a stampede coming my direction. Because all them old hairy-legged boys that had been hanging against the wall, not dancing, were looking for a fight. They took off after me, and I hit the first drunk leading the charge, and then I ducked into the woman's restroom. I may be sick, but I'm not stupid. And as I went in the door of the restroom, there was a lady standing there. And I said, tell me when the fight's over. And I went in the woman's restroom and hid out. Pretty soon she came in and said, the fight's over and the band's playing. Come on out. And I went out. She was handy. I asked her for a dance. I'm a quick study. I found out she had a job, a car, a driver's license, place to stay, money in the bank, none of which did I have. And so I said, how about taking me home with you? And that was almost 45 years ago. You betcha. I know a deal when I see one. She still has a job, a car, driver's license, money in the bank, none of which do I have. No. I said, where you been all my life, baby? I've been looking for you everywhere. And she said, where you been? I haven't seen you around. I said, well, I just got out of prison. Where'd you? She said, I just got out of an unwed mother's home. And I said, hell, we deserve each other. Unless you and I get married and give two other people a break. And we did. We dated for 2 weeks, and it was so traumatic that the people in the community nicknamed us Hatchet and Hammer. Had to be love, too painful to be anything else. Yeah. But, you know, I mean, we just went through living, screaming hell for years, 15 years, and then we got married. No. But I'm telling you, nowadays, you know, when we're in the program, we've been married a long time and in the program over 28 years, and couples come up and say, well, do you think this will work? I said, I don't know. Maybe you should just go beat the hell out of each other, claw and scratch and fight and throw each other out of cars and jump off of buildings and go to hospitals and nut wards. And then if you're still alive, maybe you ought to get married. That's what we did. I mean, really, we got to be soulmates. It's just impossible to hang on that long. Really, the truth is, it's not because I'm a good guy and loved her and always wanted to be married. The reason we're still married 42 years is because she does not believe in divorce. Homicide, but not divorce. But we set out a life of just absolute insanity and running and gunning. And I love the deal. I don't care if it's 50 cents or 50 million. I've always been in a deal. I always got something going. I like the action. I'm always doing something, and I'm always in trouble. Yeah, I'm one of the kind of guys that'll have rent money on the 5th, and I'll spend it by the 10th just to see if I can make it back by the 29th. You know? I love it, you know. And but it just makes non-drinkers crazy. Enablers just go absolutely insane. I had all kinds of enablers around me all the time, always fixers, always wanted to fix it. And I never knew what needed to be fixed. If I had a problem, I'm the kind of guy that'll wreck the car, come home, she'll say, the car is wrecked, and I'll set the house on fire so we won't talk about the car anymore. No problem here, you know. Oh, man. And the heat got on. We had to move. I didn't really geographic my family a lot. I went a lot of places, but I had a drunken uncle lived in California, and so he said, well, help me get a deal or something out there. So we loaded up everything in an old station wagon. I had an old Chevrolet station wagon, laid the seats down, piled everything in there. Had a trailer with all the stuff piled in the back. It looked like the grapes of wrath. Had a 120-pound German Shepherd dog that chewed all the hair off his body everywhere his mouth would reach, you know, just had a twitch and lip. You know, one of them where half their mouth is dry, so the lip's always hung up there. Had an Easter bunny with ringworm. Toss him in there. You know, he stayed put because the dog always licked the rabbit, you know. They always licked the rabbit. Looks like a furry ball over there all licked up. The cat had a permanent puff tail. By then we had a kid. The kid looked like a wounded animal. Sue had her hair up in a big old thing, you know, with about a can and a half of spray net in it, you know. It always looked like the Leaning Tower of Pizza. I went by a drugstore and got this girl that I knew that dated a guy that I knew to fill my baggie prescription bottle at 3 o'clock in the morning. Go through the pharmacy and get your prescription filled. That's a sandwich baggie with everything that's got an open top on it. You know, you pile all that stuff in there and get you a case of beer. Get ready to go. Most people could make the trip I made in, well, maybe 3 days. Took me about 32. I was lost a lot. I remember one time she said, why don't you pull in here and ask somebody where we are? And I said, I'm not going to do that. Then they'll know I'm lost. I don't want anybody to know I'm lost. And we got there. Well, I'd knocked the mirror off the right side of the station wagon, and she was hanging out the window to see if anybody's in that lane, you know. I got busted. As soon as I got to California, I got busted for having, they have a law against human rearview mirrors out there. And drunken uncle got me a place to stay, moved into this house. Nobody lived there in a couple of years. And had a couple of yards of gravel piled in the backyard back there, big old mound of gravel growing up, grass growing up through it. And a couple of antiques in the front yard, an Etzel. So you can have that car, goes with it. You know, and we lived there for, I don't know how many years. We quit paying rent, and the guy said, you know, you're not paying rent, you might as well buy the place. So I said, okay. So we bought it. And, you know, once you buy a place, if you're living, you know, one of them rent-to-buy things, why, then as soon as you buy, well, you need to start doing home improvements. So I started, you know, figuring I'd paint the house, you know. But I lost interest easy. I always was drinking in somebody's garage that had some paint. You know, what's that over there? Oh, that's some paint I was going to paint to something, chicken coop or something, you know. Well, I'll take it. So I'd go home and I'd paint one side of the house with that paint, and then I'd lose interest, and I'd go to somebody else's garage for a while, sit around. Hey, man, you got some paint over here, huh? Yeah. So I get another color paint, and I come back, paint that end of the house, you know. And my house is painted 4 different colors. I mean, you know, it wasn't like red and yellow and green. It was brown and cream and red and yellow. You could see it. When you went down my street, you knew somebody impotent lived there. There wasn't a door jamb in that house. It wasn't kicked off the hinges and stuck back up on, you know. Some of the door jams are all split, and You know, there were pictures hanging down low. Pictures. We went to, I moved close to Tijuana so we could go get those satin velvet pictures of those ladies and bowls of fruit. You know, they're cheap down in Tijuana. Sometimes it took 2 or 3 days to get 2 pictures out of Tijuana. But we made it. And hang them in the house down low. No frames. Those pictures have no frames. So she told me one time, you know, all our pictures have no frames. No problem. I got a friend with a pickup. We went to Tijuana, and we bought some picture frames. We brought all these picture frames back to my house and hung them on those pictures. And some pictures were this big with a frame that big. And so I took pen and tail pen and wrote little pictures in between the picture and the frame. Fill in, I called them. No, but none of my friends ever said anything bad about that. But when those Seventh-day Adventist people or whatever come over there, the church drive people, you'd let, come on in. They'd sit down in there and they'd be looking there. They start looking. Look, you can tell when they start trying to read that stuff in between the picture and the frame. Strange. People would come to our house, try to help us, and we'd beat them up. Sue and I, we'd be fighting, and people, well-meaning people would come over and say, if you'll come down to the church and get baptized, I know everything will be better. And we'd beat them up and send them out, and then we'd go in and make love. The best thing I ever saw. Passion. Some people call it foreplay. Well, I had a run of bad luck. I ended up in jail, and I was in front of a judge who remembered me. And I'd been arrested 57 times for assault and battery and resisting arrest within a 10-mile area of my house. And he had it all right there in front of him. And he said, whap, you're going to prison. I said, phew. Alcoholics, man, you got to get up early. I was sitting out in the hallway before I went to see that judge, chained to a bunch of losers. I mean, convicts. And some guy came along down the aisle there, and he was handing out AA literature. I didn't know what AA was. I'd been doing B&B myself. But he said it, something, a little, one of those little pamphlets about AA, and he was stuck there. I said, give me that. And I held it in my hand. So when that judge said, I've got all your information here, you know, all this and all this. This was before anger management, folks. Don't. Back in the good old days when the cops were afraid to shoot you. Anyway, he was going to sentence me to 3 to 5 years in prison. And I whipped this AA pamphlet up, stuck it right up there. Oh, AA, are you willing to try AA? Sure. I might have been drunk, but I knew that there was people in prison that I owed money to. I did not want to see them. I don't know anybody in AA. Whatever that is, I'll go there. You give an alcoholic an even break, and he'll take the path of least opposition. So they had an old guy come and get me, and he brought me. Good to see you folks come in late. You probably start reading in the middle of the big book. Oh, that's all right. Those are Al-Anons. They've driven a long way. Find your significant other and sit down, please. Sit by your sponsor. We know them. I normally wouldn't give them that much time in my talk if I didn't know them. Anyway, I'm over there, and the AA guy comes to get me. They had Ivan Miller come and get me. Ivan Miller was sober 26 years, and he looked like he was drunk that afternoon. Ivan Miller's hands drug on the ground. He was an old machinist, and they had all the oil and grease and chiseled hands, and a beautiful little guy. And Ivan Miller came, got me over there in the courtroom that day, and, you know, if you want what I have, And I followed Ivan out to his old pickup, man. It was all twisted and torn, beat up. And he took me over by an AA meeting and said, "This is AA. Oh, boy." And took me and dropped me off. He said, "There's a meeting there tonight." And I went in. I'd been in a fight and lost. Very unfortunate. But guy hit me upside the head with a crescent wrench and almost tore my ear off. And so I'd spent Saturday night and Sunday in a jail ward at the hospital getting my stuff sewed back on. And I had this big turban on my head with this blood-soaked ear muff. And had a beard down to here and hair down to my butt. No underwear, no socks. Traveling pretty light, really. No identification. Don't need any identification. You go up in front of a judge that knows you. And so they said, "All right, gonna go to A&A. So I went home and laid on the old vinyl couch and bled and stuck to the couch. And she came home and said she'd been to see a lawyer, and that lawyer said I should go to AA. So I let her think it was her idea. And okay, so meeting starts at 8:30, and it's over at 10. So at 8 o'clock, she come over there and got her butcher knife out. That was her weapon of choice. For 15 years, we slept with our weapons of choice. Every time we slept in a bed with each other, she slept with a 12-inch butcher knife stuck, either with the handle sticking out of the mattress there, had a little special place, holster, and I slept with a loaded 45 with a round in the chamber and the safety off on my nightstands. And those weapons were not for people outside of the house. So she peeled me off the couch. We get out, and at that time our family wagon was a Pinto, an old baby poop brown Pinto with no reverse. Went down the road crooked, had a hole in the muffler. Inside of it was all the dog lick and dog hair all over the windows inside there. And we got the dog and the cat and the kid and me in there. And we headed for the first A&A meeting and pull up in front of this church, a big AA sign out there, you know. And I remember looking at that AA sign thinking, "Oh, man, I sunk to the bottom now." If any of my friends see me going in here, I'm through. That's called low-bottom snobbery, baby, when you're down there on that level and you're afraid somebody will see you get recovery. I used to drive, when it'd rain, I'd drive through people's front yards until I got stuck and then just leave the car. Now here I am in my neighborhood, on my street, I did that several times. And now I'm about to go to an AA meeting, and I'm afraid somebody's going to see me go in here and get sober. You think I'm crazy drunk? Wait till I sober up. Ha, ha, ha. And I went in there. I looked around. I wouldn't even have drank with anybody in that room, man. What a bunch of losers. I got my ear-soaked blood muff, and she's waiting right outside the door. Sponsorship? Yes, I have a sponsor. See that woman in the Pinto? She's got a 12-inch butcher knife. That's my sponsor. Nobody offered me a ride home. There was an Al-Anon meeting right next door to the AA meeting, but there was nothing wrong with her. So I did that for a while and beat the deal down at the courthouse. And then I got drunk. That's because I wasn't through. You're not through till you're through. If you ain't through, you ain't through. And I wasn't through. So I drank from 1970 to 1976 trying to get through. Damn near killed me. But I know from that if you're not through, you're not through. And when I want to drink, I drink. And God never did come down and knock a drink out of my hand. I remember pulling up in the bar one time, set a drink down there and said, "Okay, God, I'm getting ready to drink that. If you don't want me to drink that and run through the lives of others, take that drink out of my hand." Took that drink, put it right up. "Okay, God. Okay, God, thanks. I'll just go ahead and drink now." And got baptized. I went and got baptized one time. Had a half a pack of beech nut in my mouth. Had the holy robe on and nothing else. Dumped me in the holy water and I threw up. Have you ever seen what happens with a half a pack of beech nut floating in the holy water there? That ain't good. Guy said, you're going to hell. Believe me, I'm already there. Nothing worked. Shock treatments, they shocked me into the state of smallness. And it was just good. I didn't quite have the same results because I was doing LSD at the same time. Had some really good trips. Kind of like watching 2001. I did a lot of speed. Now, I know it's an outside issue, but in the big book, there's 43 stories, and there's 17 stories that talk about substance other than alcohol. So if you did a little dope or drugs or something like that, you could fit in AA. Now, you young people that do drugs only, keep coming back so that you can keep the old folks from taking pills. Anyway, I did it all. I'm a pig. Only thing I've never had is a pap smear. Sue went and got one the other day. She said, you better quit saying that. You don't know what you got to go through. But I drank with people who would have given me one, given a chance. And I'm a blackout drinker, so you never know. Man, it was rough. It was rough. Oh. People say I came today and I fell at home and I never drank again. I think that is fantastic. But I had a long journey once I came to AA. I would sit in meetings drunk and a guy would say, you need a ride home? And I'd say, I don't know. What step you on? Now, have you read the book? And I walked home. You really get mad at your group? Get drunk and go to an AA meeting and then get up in the middle of the meeting and go sit outside the door and listen to them laugh in there. Those plastic people. They don't know what real living is. And they all come out the door and go home and they don't even say nothing to you. You're sitting outside the meeting hall. Dark, lonely night. AA doesn't work either. I got a big book. Poured beer on it. Threw up on it, tore pages out of it. I'd take a page out of the big book and take it to the meeting, hand it to a guy. What do you think of that? They'd say things to me like, probably work better if you'd keep the rest of the book. Yeah. I did the steps drunk. I'm powerless over alcohol, and I threw up on my book. My life's unmanageable. Yeah, I just crapped my pants right here. That's crazy. Okay. I never got so bad that I was sitting at Kinko's naked at midnight, though. I'll tell you that. We got some weird ones in California. But I went to AA meetings drunk. I went to AA meetings sober. Got up and went, got drunk. Came out of a blackout in an AA meeting. That's scary. I would have left, but I didn't know who brought me. But I'd go home from an AA meeting, and she'd want to have a meaningful conversation about money. And I'd say, well, don't worry, I'll give you a check. I'm the kind of guy that would put $100 in 8 different banks and write $8,000 worth of checks. She'd go to jail for my checks, kite and paper, So when I'd say, I'll give you a check, the fight would be on, and then I'd be drunk again. And then I'd go back to AA, and then I'd sit in an AA meeting, honk and sniff on the ladies, go home and tell her, get in the bedroom, I'm horny. I've been to an AA meeting. Those women smell better than you. And then we'd have a big discussion about who's Lore companion. And then I'd big fight, and then I'd be off down Anaheim Street in Long Beach with the ladies of the evening. Drunk again, come back to AA, go to an AA meeting, come home and, they say, we cease fighting everything and everybody. And she'd take one step close to me and I'd say, don't take another step or I'm going to hit you. And she'd take one step closer, bam, the fight would be on. And I'd be drunk again. And I was going to AA meetings, but I was going home to a drunken house. I was going home to a crazy house. See, the same me will always drink again. See? And nothing was changing. I was going home. There was no recovery at home. And I was just getting sicker and sicker and sicker. And I stand in that kitchen, take a drink off a bottle of vodka, look down a hallway. 9-year-old girl standing at the end of the hallway, her chin on her chest and her hair in her face. And she didn't say anything. She just watching me to see which direction I was going. So she'd go the other way. I'd take a drink out of that bottle and look back, and she'd be gone. I didn't have to have that drink because I was ashamed of what was going on. I had to have that drink because there was a phenomenon, a craving, that made it necessary for me to take a drink once I took a drink. See? And I didn't understand that. And I know what it's like to crawl across the floor of my own kitchen, reaching in there in the cabinet for a bottle hidden back behind the pots and the pans, and a lip dragging drunk, and drag that bottle out, and I'm sucking on that bottle laying on the kitchen floor, and look up, and a little 10-year-old girl's looking at me with that pitiful, incomprehensible demoralization, and I gurgle around there and say, "What are you looking at?" And she'd run away. She just wanted to know which direction I was going, so she'd go the other way. And we lived like that, not a day or a week or a month. We lived like that from about 1972 to 1976. Sometime in 1976, we bought the house and paid $20,000 for it, and by 1976, I owed $150 on it. The property had come up, though, don't worry. But I had borrowed and borrowed on that house to get bondsmen and lawyers and corrupt the whole place. And I had one last deal. I owed Aetna and Avco Finance. It was a gold card carrier for Aetna and Avco and Household Finance. I owed about $260,000 to people, and I had nothing to show for it. And I needed some money, and some people gave me an opportunity to transport some cocaine from Los Angeles to San Francisco, and I took the job in a vehicle, and I got me a quart of whiskey, and I went about 100 miles up the coast, and by there I had drank a half a quart of whiskey, and I had an alcoholic idea, like, I think I'll steal the coke. So I turned right and went inland and hid $250,000 worth of cocaine, drank the rest of the whiskey, and forgot where I hid it. That's how I know I'm an alcoholic, not an addict. But I sobered up and knew I was in a lot of trouble because I couldn't remember where I hid the stuff. And so I went over and hid out sometime in January of 1976. Hid out in a little small town up mid-California there, about outside of Bakersfield, called Taft, California. Has anybody here ever been to Taft, California? I hope you have. Dude, you know what I'm talking about. If the world's got an asshole, it's Taft. It ain't hell, but you can see it from there, right? Right. But a good place to hide. I mean, all the way up Taft. You got to know somebody. The room was $50 a year out at that old barracks. And I locked in there somewhere in January of 1976, and by May, hadn't gone anywhere, couldn't get anywhere, wasn't sobering up, wasn't getting drunk. And I crawled out of there and went back to AA. Because that's what happens to you, man. If you don't die and you go out there and drink, you're going to have to come back to AA. That's it. Back to AA. I mean, back to AA. I went back to AA, man. And took a while for getting anybody 12-stepped me, but a guy finally 12-stepped me and put me in a detox, something I'd never done. I'd been punished for lying, cheating, stealing, all kinds of things, but I never had been detoxed. And these people locked me up and detoxed me with nothing. Nothing. I said, "How about some hard candy or Valium or something?" I said, "No, eat a banana. You need potassium." And they locked me up, and I'd take 3 steps and laugh and 3 steps and cry. And it was just, I detoxed about every all week, 10 days. I'd kick something else. And man, it was just terrible. I don't ever want to do that again, man. Please, God. I don't ever want to detox again. I have times in sobriety when it's been rough, but I never want to detox again. Yeah, it was bad, bad time. At 52 days sober, I remembered where I hid the cocaine, and I was in an AA meeting. I know where it is. I didn't ask my sponsor if he wanted to take a ride with me. I went and got the stuff and gave it back. And the people said, "Don't call us. We'll call you." But I learned something. I walked across the parking lot and got in my car and drove back to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And when I walked across that parking lot, I knew that every good thing in my life is going to be preceded by a wall of fear. If I want the good in life, I'm going to have to walk through those walls of fear. And I drank and used to keep from, I ran through those walls of fear, but I had to walk through the walls of fear to get the good. And I can assure you, in over 28 years, I've walked through many walls of fear and many to come. But the reward is great, and the strength is phenomenal. And I also share that particular story, not in braggadero or the outside issue, but in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, there is a part, and in the 12 and 12, there's parts that allude to the fact that your enemies will welcome you. Please be careful of that. Don't rush into the arms of your enemies because you've opened the doors of AA. Be cautious of that. And I have some experience. And I rushed in there and took care of business, no big deal. And I started going to meetings, and I had a sponsor. I've always had a sponsor. I'm a product of strong sponsorship. I worked the steps. They weren't that hard. And, you know, Sue went to Al-Anon. My daughter went to Al-Team. My dog went to Al-Dog. My cat went to Al-Cat. And they released me into the arms of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I was just absorbed. I don't know why I sobered up and stayed sober in May, but I did, and I'll take it. And I haven't questioned it. I embraced it. It's very, very precious to me, and I've done exactly what they told me to do. And the people that 12-stepped me and stuck with me said the thing that ensures your sobriety greater than anything else is working with another alcoholic. And, you know, I started working with other alcoholics very, very early, and I had my sponsor told me, you know, he'd help me, and I got to be a secretary of a group, and, you know, I had to do all the things, hug people, and I had to count the money and not steal it. Well, I'd leave IOUs, you know, but, you know, I had to start making amends at home and those kind of things. Sue would got involved in Al-Anon, and my daughter got involved in Al-Ateen. And I never brought any more drunks back in the house. I'd brought enough, and there was always Al-Anons at our home and Al-Ateens, and I'm grateful for that. And, you know, by the time I was 3 years sober, I was stark raving sober. I worked the steps. I polished the chairs and set up the stuff and got a new big book and went through it four times with Joe and Charlie. And I just was dying. Sitting in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. Dying is like it's tattooed on my forehead. Loser. I was paying the money back. I was doing everything right. And I was just sober. And Sue's Al-Anon sponsor said, "What if he's as good as he's ever going to be?" She said, "Well, he's still better than he was. I'll take it." You know, my daughter was going to Alateen all the time, and I would go to meetings, and I'd lay in bed and, you know, think. And I'd work the steps, and I'd prayed every morning, and read my meditation books. And at about a little over three years sober, two and a half years sober, I went through that thing. It is better to understand than to be understood. That happens at about 2.5 years sobriety, right in there. I almost went crazy trying to understand what it was that I wasn't supposed to understood. And they told me, "Quit reading that prayer. It's confusing you." I hated everybody in Alcoholics Anonymous. Hated everybody. I wasn't prejudiced. Hated everybody equal. Bleeding out of every opening of my body. 3 years sober, my fingernails was just white. And there was a medical doctor who was a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous sitting down next to him. And he looked, said, "Look at my hand." And my fingernails were white, white, white. And he said, "You're sick." And I said, "I know it. Give me my hand back. What are you?" And he said, "No, something's wrong with you." So they took me over to the hospital and put me in an intensive care unit. And the doctor pumped 9 pints of blood back in me. And Sue came to see me, and the doctor said, "You know, the body only has something like 13 pints of blood, and we just put 9 pints of blood back in this guy. Do you realize he didn't have enough blood in him that if he would have sneezed, he would have had brain damage?" And she said, how would we have known the difference? I'm laying there in this intensive care unit, 3 years sober. And all these people from AA came, stood beside my bed in the intensive care unit and said, don't die. We love you. I was so weak I couldn't flip them off. 12 of them came over and watched them give me a bone marrow test in the pelvis. And went back, had a discussion meeting about it. And I don't know, man. These doctors said, oh, we don't know what's wrong with you. All of a sudden, there are some people, a 1% of the human race, that just unexpectedly pops and just bleeds for some reason. We don't understand it. We need to do an exploratory operation on you. And I said, see ya. Man, I jumped up, got my clothes, got the hell out of there, man. I ain't going to do that. And I faked it long enough. And I went to the meeting, and my sponsor said, well, you ready to start work with others now? I love old-timers that wait until the newcomers, you know, with years, a few years of sobriety, are just ready to implode. You're just sober, and you're just ready to just suck in like a vacuum and just disintegrate, right, and splatter all over them right in the middle of the closing prayer. And I'm standing there, and all of a sudden I look around, and there's a guy standing next to me, ain't short enough to be a midget or tall enough to be a man. Weird guy. I seen him. Had a welder's hat pulled down over one ear. Painted his feet black so it looked like he had socks on so he didn't have to do laundry. I said, do you do that to your underwear too? What do you want? Bob the cop had given me a grenade. We have a bomb squad. I'm sure you don't have one here in Austin, but in California we need bomb squads. And they have alcoholics on the bomb squad too. Isn't that a scary thought? Bob the cop gave me a grenade. It was a dummy grenade, but I didn't know it. And he said, here, when it gets really bad, probably about when you're 3.5 years sober, put this in your mouth and pull the pin and it'll all be over. And I had my little grenade that I carried around with me. And this guy asked me, you know, he's standing next to me, he said, will you be my sponsor? And I thought, oh, man, I've really made God mad somewhere. Man. But here, hold my grenade. I go over to my sponsor. He's standing over on the other side. I said, did you see that guy over there? He said, yep. I said, he asked me to be his sponsor. And my sponsor says, yeah, I know. I sent him over there. Go there and tell him you'll help him. I wanted to hit him. You can't say anything. You just kind of look stupid and your mouth and your chin quivers when you want to rebuttal your sponsor. You ever notice that? If you argue with them, they go crazy and the little vein in their forehead just pulsates. I went back, give me my grenade. By then I had a car, AA car, 3.5 years sober. You got to have an AA car. So if anybody says, how you doing? I said, look at my car. I'm doing fine. Had a big Lincoln, Mark IV Lincoln, parked it right in front of the meeting. And a guy says, I want to go for a ride in your Lincoln. So, all right, you go out that door, I'll go out this door. He said, no, I want to go with you. And he grabbed me by the arm. Walking up there, two guys I knew leaning against the door jamb. And Weirdo says, that's my new sponsor. And he points at me, you know. And I said, don't tell those people I'm your sponsor. And they looked at us and said, boy, it's going to be fun to watch you two grow. I got in my car. He started talking weird stuff and all that stuff, man. I mean, crazy stuff. I said, we need God. He said, oh, man, we need more than God. We need a miracle. Yeah. What are you talking about? He said, you know, we need a sign, you know, like parting of the water or a burning bush or something. I think if I had a lighter fluid, I'd torch the hedge over there. But had a gun in the glove box, a .45 automatic. I put it in. I'm taking it from the nightstand to the glove box in my car at 3.5 years sober. Slow growth. I put it upside his head. I said, I'll count to 10. You pray. If I don't have a floating resentment, decided to pop a cap on you, why, you've just done step 3. Yeah. Spiritual. Hey, we're both still sober. That was 27 years ago, 26 years ago. Yeah. Well, look at them guys over there. Yeah. Had to get a cannon for them. But we made it, man. That guy come over to my house, had a big book, and he beat on the door and wanted to come in and do the steps, and I let him in my house, and we went in the kitchen, got on our knees, and did the third step prayer. And Then he wanted to do a four-step, and I said, you're supposed to have that done before you get to your sponsor's house. And he said, no, I can't write. So I'll talk, you write. And so he started talking, and I started writing. And I remembered a couple of things I wasn't going to tell anybody. And since he couldn't read, I just put my stuff in his. Hey, man, let me tell you something. God sends a dumpster. Don't wait for the lifeboat. Put it in the dumpster. Drop the garbage. Don't carry it any longer, man. I laid a load on that guy. We burned it, and he jumped up and kissed me on the cheek and said, I love you, and ran out in the front yard and said, I love you, and away he went. You know, and it dropped from the head to the heart that day. And I've been doing that ever since. Been doing that ever since. And I was able to go to work. I was able to work, get a job. That's a social shock. With a boss. And I'd worked as a union member for a number of years. I told Sue, no matter even if I'm in prison, pay my union dues. Good Al-Anon woman, paid my union dues. Jails, nut wards, outstanding member. Outstanding over at the nut ward. But he's a member. And I, at 60 years old, I was able to retire with 42 years of retirement in a union have union retirement insurance. Sue got her new hip from my union insurance. That's living a man's baby. It took a long time to replace that hip. She got that, from falling off them car hoods, you know. But I had insurance for her. I was able to do that. That's a living amends. Years and years later, when she needed it, I was able to do that. And I was able to work and pay back my financial amends. It took me 14 years of sobriety to pay back my financial amends, and I didn't have an overwhelming good feeling about it. I just did it because I didn't want to drink. And the amazing thing is that 14 years of sobriety, I was paying back that financial amends. I would be sitting places thinking, I can't do that. I'm not even going to try that. I can't do that job. And I'd get up and go apply for all the jobs I didn't think I could get and do all those kind of applications and what have you to work and improve myself. And, you know, by the time I was 14 years sober and paid back all that money, I was working, making more money than I ever thought I could. If I'd have just been sitting somewhere on my butt on the couch thinking, well, I'm not going to do that, I'm not going to try that, and I'm not going to pay back my financial amends, I'd still be sitting on that couch. But because I paid back my financial amends because I wanted to stay sober, I would apply for these jobs and I'd get them. And by the time I was 14 years sober, I was making good enough money to live on, brought my family up and our standard of living up and paid that stuff back. And that's the most important thing about 8 and 9 is that I had to pay it back. I remember my dad was one of the last ones I had to pay back. He said, you ever going to pay me that money back? And I said, I doubt it. That's about the best amends I can make to you is tell you I probably won't pay it back. But at 14 years sober, I was able to ask him. I said, Dad, what do you take for me to rub that note out? And he knew right away. He was sober, but he knew. So I went and wrote him a check. And I handed him the check. And my wife was standing there next to my dad. And my dad looked at the check and looked at her and said, you think it's good? Some people never trust you, you know. But I paid him back. And, I've had amends. I killed a person in a bar fight. And that amends, I was sitting in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous one night, and I got there late, so I had to sit up front, and there was a coffee bar in the back, and they brought a load of newcomers in, and a guy went into DTs and a fit and swallowed his tongue, and I was the only one that could see him in the back of the room, and I ran across the room and back there and got a popsicle stick and pulled his tongue out of his throat. And paramedics said I saved his life. I don't know. But I tell you what amazed me was that I'm the kind of guy that would have sat on that chair thinking, that's none of my business. I'm not even going to get involved. When a man and a dog gets run over in the street, I'll help the dog, but not the man. But that night I went over there, and I guess I saved that guy's life. I don't know. But I know this, when I put my head on a pillow that night and thought about how am I ever going to make amends for the lives I took, I felt a little easier there. There was a little better balance. I don't know about you. I'm telling my story. And there's been several of those things happen where people literally have told me that I saved their life. I'll take it. I'll take it. I won't take credit for it, but I'll take it to help me balance when I put my head on the pillow. Very, 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 very wild and grotesque and violence, a lot of violence. Sue and I are very, very violent people. I'm not talking about temper tantrums, slick. I'm talking about physical violence where people die. And, how am I going to recover from that? And I knew that I couldn't, have the violence and stay sober. I haven't hit anybody since May 11th, 1976. I haven't cheated on my wife since May 11th, 1976. I haven't written a hot check since May 11th, 1976. Nor have I debated God since May 11th, 1976. And if talking about God offends you, I'm sorry, but I'd rather offend you than God. I offended him way too long. Okay? So I want to tell you a story. Because I like to tell stories. Maybe you've heard it, but I like telling it. There was a story about a family, mother and father, a little boy and a little girl. They lived in the South, maybe somewhere during the Dust Bowl years, poor family on a farm. They didn't have much. And they'd never had any, luxuries of life. They lived out on that farm. And every year at the end of the year, it took everything they raised from their crops to be able to survive. And so they got together one time, maybe at Christmas time or something. And they decided that they would buy something. They would work all year, whatever. They'd save their money. And they would buy something for the whole family. Something they could all appreciate. And they would order it in this catalog. And they would put the money together and they would order it. And so they decided together that they would buy a mirror. They'd never, ever seen the reflection of any other than looking one or the other, but never seen a reflection of themselves. And so they saved their money and they ordered the mirror. And the day came when they delivered the mirror and they were so happy and they brought it in. And of course it was a special occasion. Before they unwrapped it, they all put on their best. And the father put on his best suit and mother put on her best dress, and the little girl primped and got herself ready, and the little boy was all ready. And so the father, they unwrapped the mirror, and the father, a proud man, hard-working man, stood in front of the mirror and adjusted his coat. And the family looked at him in the mirror, and he was proud to see himself. He could see all the years of the hard work, but he was a proud man, and he felt good about himself. And the mother, it was her turn, and she stood in front of the mirror in her dress, and the age and the years had shown on her face, but she was still a good mother, a good mom, a good wife. And the reflection in the mirror was just that. And the family looked in the joy of the mom standing there for the first time, seeing the reflection of herself. And of course, the daughter got in front of the mirror and she pinched her cheeks and she looked at herself in the mirror and giggled and oohed and aahed. And the family was so excited. And the little boy, it was his turn. Now, when the little boy was probably, I don't know, maybe 5 or 6 years old. Now, at the time they got the mirror, maybe 9. But at 5 or 6 years old, he was out in the barn jackassing around with his dad, milking the cows. And the cow kicked the little boy in the face. So the little boy's face was grotesque and twisted. And he'd never seen the reflection of himself. He had no idea, other than the accident and the pain, and it healed. And he was going on with his life for a number of years. So when the little boy stepped in front of the mirror, there he saw it. And all the grotesque and twisted of his face was ugly. And it was all torn and twisted, and he'd never seen that reflection of himself. And his first reaction, his mother standing next to him, his first reaction, he screamed out. He grabbed his mother's leg and said, "Mommy, Mommy, how can you love me? I'm so ugly." And the mother, being a good mother, held the little boy and said, "Son, I can love you because you're mine." Sitting here tonight, the ugliness that we all know of ourselves and other people. Maybe some of us haven't even really seen that yet. But I'll tell you something. You know that in your heart and in your soul. God loves you because you're His. God bless and thank you.